Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Sanctuary in the Trees. Bluebird days, fresh snowfall, chick digs, lush forest, fantastic food, an ATV, and a horse, of course. Could you ask for anything more during a wonderful winter getaway at Montana's Green O? By Jordan Rain. What'll it be on this cold winter's night way out on the rugged range of Big Sky Country? The pizza? Or the 8-course tasting menu, opening with a playful fish stick, amuse-bouche, followed by a page-long pageantry of small plates, including scallop and saffron, wagyu and caviar, venison and mallard, salmon and kohlrabi, and so on, before closing with a pair of flirty desserts called quince and sunchoke and chocolate and smoke. Arriving in the dark less than 10 minutes ago at the snow-swirled gates of the Green O, a new luxury hideaway tucked in the woods at one of western Montana's most storied guest and cattle ranches, it can take an extra moment for this weighty decision to fully thaw, especially if you've just flown in from tepid Los Angeles. 2 quick flights and 1 parallel universe ago, I was stuck in L.A.'s gridlock on a 76-degree late December day, then crammed inside LAX's notorious Terminal 6 with throngs of dour folks in T-shirts and pandemic masks. Now, suddenly, I'm in boot-crunching, breath-viewing, pine-surrounding real-deal winter, way out in a sweeping valley about 30 miles from Missoula, but otherwise sufficiently off the grid. Peeling off thermal layers and warming up inside the Green O's social house, a cozy chick dining rotunda decked out in charred Japanese shusugi ban wood, with a showpiece central fireplace and floor-to-ceiling windows overlooking a silhouetted forest seasoned heavily with snow, I'm still playing catch-up with the present moment. 10 feet from my table is an open kitchen staffed with James Beard caliber chefs at the ready. Later, I'll check into a sleek private abode hidden in the trees, bask in a steaming private outdoor hot tub under a confetti shower of Montana-sized snowflakes, sip Syrah by the fire, and slumber under a skylighted roof of constellations. Over the next few days, winter conditions depending, I'll be further provisioned with an assortment of cold season activities that might include snowshoeing and dog sledding. But back to tonight's opening question. Pizza or 10-course fantasy meal? This will be my first of many real tough decisions during 17 hours of deep winter escape at the Green O. You can't go wrong with either. The pizza is out of this world too, assures Buck, my server, bartender, concierge, and difficult decision facilitator, handing me a local Scepter IPA to ease the stress. Really, the only mistake you can make is leaving without trying both. Buck smiles reassuringly. And we won't let that happen here. Nestled on a 37,000-acre luxury resort and working cattle property in the heart of Montana's Blackfoot River Valley, the Green O is one of those formula-defying places you need to just gratefully go along with to get a delicious handle on. Opened in June 2021 by the folks behind the family-oriented resort at Paws Up, just down the road, this new adults-only retreat, sequestered on its own forested corner of the ranch, shares the same vast river valley landscape as its larger sister property. Otherwise, the Green O is very much its own brand and concept. The main thing I've been hearing from guests at the Green O is that it's just so unexpected to have a design-forward resort with cutting-edge architecture and world-class cuisine in the middle of a remote forest in Montana, says Lawrence Lipsum, co-owner and managing director of both resorts. Guests who come to either of our properties appreciate the finer things in life, but they also aren't afraid to get their hands dirty and try new things, whether it's rappelling, fly fishing, sporting clays, or something else that could end up becoming a life passion, Lipsum adds, before drawing distinctions between the two places. Paws Up has a lot of rough-hewn, big timber architecture, and is more in keeping with a cabin-type Montana product with all the bells and whistles, and a culinary style viewed as more refined rustic ranch. What we felt like we needed for the Green O was much more of an architecture and design-forward project, with cuisine that sometimes verges on the experimental. Privacy. Celebrities have been known to show up for a quiet, anonymous stay. Refinement, think Mother Nature's penthouse, and adventure, outdoor and gustatory. However you care to approach that trifecta, it awaits in myriad combinations at the Green O, whether you're sharing this unique spot with a special someone or hogging it all to yourself. During my own solo stay here in early winter, shortly before the Christmas holidays, the resort will be a revolving door of peaceful refuge, culinary thrills, and Western-style winter fun and adventure, all wrapped inside a rustically sleek, or is it sleekly rustic, hideaway designed for the ultimate escapist, yin-yang, full engagement and blissful disengagement. Spread seamlessly across a thickly timbered hillside, the Green O's dozen ultra-modern, open-concept two-person homes, or houses, so dubbed in a nod to the European, Scandinavian-influenced architecture, are accurately enough described by the resort as sanctuaries in the trees. The most arresting of them is the tree house, perched more than 20 feet above the ground with more than 1,000 square feet of living space, the lofty two-story cabin's interior spiral staircase leads to a fully windowed master bedroom suite overlooking the forest like a crow's nest. When I take a peek inside, a family of white-tailed deer are traipsing through the snowy woods directly below. You don't have to wait very long before it turns into a total Disney movie here, says Jeff Severini, the resort manager, an avid fly fisherman drawn out to these parts from the D.C. area, while touring me through the Green O's signature house in the Pines. My own cozy digs, the Green House, are graced with a broad double-sided gas fireplace to also be enjoyed outside on a wooden deck, equipped with an on-demand 104-degree hot tub. Inside, the whole pad is bathed in warm earth tones and cool vibes. From the pitch-ceilinged living room, with an entire windowed wall overlooking the forest, to a slightly sunken bedroom area fitted with a large skylight, thoughtfully lining up with exactly where your head hits the pillow for sleepy stargazing. Touch screen controls are everywhere, for everything. And no, they didn't forget the rainfall shower, stylish trough sink, oversized soaking tub, and heated commode seat. Folksy details are also everywhere, softening the chic factor. A French bulldog statue playfully stands guard near the Echo kitchen. A painting of a sheep branded with a large Green O on its back hangs on the wall. The livestock brand used by the ranch's original jocular owner, Paul Greenough, a century ago. There's a coffee table book entitled The Architecture of Trees, and Scrabble and Twister are accommodatingly stashed on an upper shelf if you need them. You'd be hard-pressed to ever leave this house if it weren't for a broad lineup of enticing winter activities hosted by the adjacent resort at Paws Up. On tap for today, a private horse whispering clinic with Paws Up's equestrian manager, Jackie Kekas. And there's no doubt I could use one. I'd like to feel more comfortable around horses, I tell Jackie when she asks me what I want to get out of this session. I don't feel like they take me all that seriously. She nods understandingly, but she can't help pondering aloud how this intel jibes with her assumption about the riding chops of a longtime rider for Cowboys and Indians. After I humbly explain that I'm a longtime Angeleno, with more time hiking on the coast than bushwhacking in the saddle, Jackie establishes something right off the bat about today's horse whispering clinic. There will be no whispering involved. In fact, she doesn't much care for that term at all. It gives it this whole magical quality, which it's not, says Jackie, who worked with Buck Branham, the iconic horseman who Robert Redford's character is based on in The Horse Whisperer, during her formative wrangling years in Colorado. Branham wasn't a big fan of the term either, she tells me. It's not woo-woo we're talking about here. It's about energy, communication, and education on both sides of the fence. Between her many years working with horses in Colorado and now Montana, Jackie worked in childhood education. That's handy right now, too, because when it comes to horses, I've been stuck for decades in arrested childhood. The ones who are the most stuck are the people who think they know everything about horses, my straight-talking horse educator assures me, leading me to a large herd of them idling in the cold beside the resort's massive private equestrian center, the largest of its kind in Montana. I remember Buck could be especially blunt with these sorts of folks. We wander among the horses, every giant, gentle eyeball fixed on the lumbering stranger in their midst, while Jackie and her 4-year-old border collie, Duke, make their rounds like old friends. Horse body language is subtle, so it's the little things you're looking for, says Jackie, introducing me to my equestrian colleague this morning, an 11-year-old mare named Bacardi. It's in the ears, a lean on one foot, a slightly lowered head. See how Bacardi is moving her lips? That's a good sign. The four of us, teacher, student, Duke the dog, and Hot Lips Bacardi, head up Paws Up's 30,000-square-foot riding arena that's seen many a rodeo and pro equestrian performance for large crowds. Today it's just Bacardi and me entering a small circular pen. After a quick demo from Jackie, who instantly gets her trotting in a steady circle around the perimeter, telepathically it seems it's my turn. No whispering involved, just body language. Focus on the hips, Jackie instructs. The less arms, the better. It's not going well. I think the problem is I don't like telling anyone what to do, even with my hips, I tell Jackie, who tells me what to do about that. Think of it more as teaching instead of telling. Yes, it's about earning respect, but it's essentially about effective communication and developing a relationship. All the yelling and yanking in the world won't do it any if the energy isn't right. Might this apply to human relationships, one wonders, while trying this over and over again with a spectacular being named after a fine rum? After several sloppy attempts at effective communication with my patient partner, something gives, and she actually latches onto our little exercise, dutifully trotting around the perimeter of the pen. Now, how about that? It's happy hour with Bacardi, after all. Then, when I ease back on the hips, the arms, whatever I'm doing, Bacardi reapproaches. Why would she ever want to return to me after this testy workout, I wonder? Like, woo-woo, my instructor reads my mind. Horses aren't treat animals, explains Jackie, who introduces me to negative reinforcement theory. Negative doesn't mean negative here. It means removal of stimulus as the reward. Pressure and release. Push and pull. We continue to practice, Jackie providing positive reinforcement to me. Good. Establish your personal bubble. Be accountable for your body language. Don't let her decide when it's time to stop. That's your decision. Me providing positive negative reinforcement to Bacardi, and Bacardi taking me seriously, or doing an awesome job pretending. No whispering involved. When my teacher steps up to demo with Bacardi again for a few last laps, it looks like she's doing absolutely nothing, just standing there. A lot is happening here, says Jackie quietly, in almost a whisper. It's all about attention and focus, and ultimately, trust. It's a process. What I suspect will be the most memorable breakfast I've eaten in the last 51 and a half years is minutes away from being placed in front of me at the social house on a bluebird, snow-covered morning. The breakfast menu includes 8 larger plate options and 6 smaller plate options. The problem is, there are 14 things on this menu that I can't live without trying. Will it be the Dungeness crab frittata with tamagoyaki egg, daikon, togarishi, and yuzu hollandaise? Or the homemade apple fritters drizzled in honey caramel, spiced brown sugar, and walnut nougatine? Or the chamomile yogurt panna cotta with fresh berries, honeycomb, and pistachio? Or the duck and foie gras sausage? Or the... well, you get the idea. I've also been informed that the souffle omelet with foraged mushrooms and sheep's cheddar will shatter my entire preconception of omelets. It's quite an omelet, says then-morning sous chef, now executive chef of outdoor dining, Shannon Wages, standing in the open kitchen across from where I'm seated at the counter beside a giant slab of fresh honeycomb. The country fried steak, Wagyu beef with miso red eye gravy and sunny side up egg, is pretty special too. Wages, a soft-spoken powerhouse of a chef with a warm smile, earned his cooking stripes at impressive places like the Venetian in Las Vegas, and 3-star generals tables at Marine Corps Base Camp Pendleton in California. Last June, he arrived at the Green O with a team of top toques, including executive chef Brandon Cunningham and James Beard Award-nominated pastry chef Crystal Swenson. One thing we really take a lot of pride in here is taking familiar dishes everyone knows and then just running with them, pushing them somewhere you've never been before, says Wages, who makes me promise I'll try the root vegetable Reuben sandwich, featuring braised celery root treated to a pastrami spice rub, when I return for lunch in a few hours. I think we really knocked that one out of the park, too. I've never eaten a steak for breakfast, let alone country fried Wagyu, but something tells me this is the time and place. Plus, I can work off the calories during my 60-minute deep tissue massage appointment between now and my Reuben sandwich. On second thought, how can I pass up on the fried chicken and chickpea waffles with golden raisin chutney and coconut syrup? On third thought, where else am I going to get chamomile panna cotta? What a dilemma. Why is life so hard? Would it be okay if I made all 3 for you? Asks Wages, solving everything if I, in 11 words, like I'd be doing him a favor. I just love to cook, he says, which he does just a few feet away like a private master class. "We'll do the omelet tomorrow," he promises. "And the fritters." The Green O provides guests with their own Lexus hybrid to scoot around the resort, but it'll only get you so far in this place. If you really want to experience the property's beauty, immensity, and wildness, hopping on a Polaris Sportsman 570 ATV is a good way to go. Thankfully, there's a long row of them parked outside Paws Up Wilderness Outpost, where a long-haired, stubbled, beaming blonde in a one-piecer named Eric assures his bald, bundled-up client, we won't get too lost out there. "I love it here in the summer, too," says Eric, who guides fly fishing trips on the Blackfoot River during the resort's warmer, busier season. "But right now is one of the best times to come," he adds, lowering his goggles, cranking the engine, and flashing the first of many thumbs-ups during a mid-afternoon winter backcountry ATV tour. "You ready?" We blast off, throttling up a bumpy trail of sorts that leads up into the broad hills straddling the giant Blackfoot Valley. Earlier this morning, it was a cloudless blue sky. Now, in true Montana wait 5 minutes fashion, the flakes are starting to fall again. That's good news for future skijorers and for the ATVer grinning like a 10-year-old in the snow while trying to keep up with my awesome new buddy, Eric. Pulling up to a vista atop a craggy point called Lookout Rock, where summer guests rappel off a 150-foot cliff to the Blackfoot River below, we clamber to the top for a quick panorama of the sprawling, frosty valley, sprinkled with little dots, fully grown elk, poaching a snack from a ranch's faraway alfalfa fields. "I've been told that Lewis and Clark stood right here in this very spot," says Eric, with at least half a grain of salt in his voice. "Actually, I think it was just one of them," he self-corrects. "I'm not sure which, but I can check." Motoring down toward the river along a winding black route, we break periodically to examine snow prints. Not Lewis or Clark's, it turns out, but every other tread mark around here turns up. Red squirrels, coyotes, bull elk. "These ones here just happened," says Eric, pointing out some fresh deer tracks and peering around for the hooves. And as if on cue, there they are, a couple of four-point bucks trotting up the hill, stopping briefly to stare back at us before disappearing over the backside. Our turnaround point is the Blackfoot River, which winds for miles through the Paws Up property and is home to some of the finest summer glamping sites and fly fishing tours in the state. Right now, the water is rolling along frigidly. It's not that deep at the moment, but it's cold enough to turn your ankles into blue popsicles. We walk over the stony bank and onto some shallow river ice that cracks a little ominously. Directly above us, just upriver and dwarfing the giant pine trees, is Lookout Rock, where we, and it was Meriwether Lewis, stood earlier. Standing on the frozen-ish river, Eric mentions that we've technically entered public land with these few precarious steps. According to the state's Stream Access Law, 1984, rivers in Montana can't be privately owned. They flow for everyone. My final ride before reluctantly checking out of the Green O is on a horse, of course. This one is named Buckshot. "I think he'll be good for you," says my mentor, Jackie, betraying just a bit of mischief in her tone as she sets me up for the ride. There are over 100 miles of riding trails on the Paws Up property. My adios journey along the resort's signature winter loop with this 21-year-old buckskin is bound to be a pretty one, meaning pretty challenging. "He's a fantastic horse," Jackie says, "but he fancies himself king of the herd, so you'll have to set some clear terms with him right off the bat. Right. Or else Buckshot won't take me the least bit seriously. No problem. I got this. I hop on Buckshot and give him a gentle little kick, then a slightly harder one, and another. He doesn't budge. When he finally takes a few token steps, I direct him left, and he turns right. Then he starts to graze. Come on, Buckshot, I say. Please stop eating and listen to me. Pretty please? When Buckshot sneers, tells me where to stick it, and starts grazing again, something kicks in. Gently but firmly, lifting Buckshot's head, I lean forward and whisper to him. What do I say? That's our little secret, and Buckshot will never, ever tell. But his ears adjust ever so slightly, and I do believe he might be moving his lips. That's a good sign. Any moment now, we should be getting on our way. Find out more, Greeno's Summer Season and Stunning Architecture, and recipes for the Greeno's Bear Dance Cocktail, Paws Up's Chuck Wagon Dutch Oven Baked Blueberry Cobbler, and Crystal Swenson's Holiday Fave Chocolate Cake at CowboysIndians.com. A Paws Up Christmas. Holiday time at Montana's premier ranch resort is more than merry. What's the most magical time of the year to experience the resort at Paws Up with the whole crew or a special someone at its adjacent adults-only sister property, the Green O? The obvious one-word answer is anytime. But if you're really going to press us, with no offense to spectacular spring, summer, or fall in these parts, winter holiday season at the luxury ranch resort is something straight out of the Montana Santa playbook. And yes, the big jolly guy himself will be showing up here right on schedule. We tend to embrace the holiday spirit about as heavily here as Buddy the Elf, says Sonny Lynn, Paws Up senior executive chef. The streets are lit, trees are decorated, and new favorite moments are waiting to be found. Year-round, our goal is to surpass expectations of every family welcomed into our 37,000-acre home. But the holiday experience at Paws Up is filled with some real surprises, fueled by an immense responsibility to fully capture and share the whole spirit of this time and place. Paws Up Christmas Package is the resort's signature epic event of many big ones held here throughout the year. The five-night, five-star experience inevitably starts with a wow moment when first pulling into the vast property and entering its remarkable living spaces. Over the holidays, they've primed for the occasion with decorated Christmas trees and every creature comfort in a family vacation setting that Clark Griswold would only dream about. Accommodation options at Paws Up range from luxury meadow big timber homes to palatial two-story wilderness estates equipped with vault-ceilinged living rooms, chef's kitchens, three master suites, giant loft game rooms, and a pastoral backyard of snow-dusted pines and rolling meadow framed with a horizon of Montana mountainscapes. Nestled in its own separate woodsy universe just down the road, the Green O's cluster of pine-shrouded houses are wonders of contemporary design, featuring private outdoor hot tubs, stone fireplaces, and cozy, sleek suites melding into a forest shared with families of deer traipsing past wall-to-wall windows. Recreational options at the resort are as active, blissfully idle, or full-bore Christmassy as you and the family care to make them. Youngster favorites include sleigh rides, nearby snow tubing runs, and ice skating, holiday-themed scavenger hunts, and a gape-worthy gingerbread house. Last year's creation was a sugar-coated replica of our Moonlight Camp that had a footprint of 4 by 5 feet. says Jen. We began planning this year's gingerbread structure in July to elevate all expectations come December, including our own. During snowy season, guests can explore the resort's vast and varied backcountry by horse, snowmobile, dog sled, snowshoe, or ATV along miles of wintry trails. For a sybaritic apres adventure, the property's homey spa is tucked storybook fashion in an original farmhouse. Rivaling the day's adventurous highlights are culinary ones at a resort with nationwide renown for hosting one of the most happening cuisine scenes in the West. Holiday dining at Paws Up is no exception, offering a feast of locally raised, foraged, and farmed foods prepared at Pomp, the resort's fine dining space. Next day at Trough, a tasty home-cooked Western meals are served in a less formal setting. At the Green O's spectacular social house dining area, multi-course prefix meals are bar-raising gourmet events unto themselves, prepared in an open kitchen by a creative team of award-winning chefs. The social house is perfect for adult families to come together and enjoy an intimate holiday experience, says Brandon Cunningham, executive chef at the Green O. We take holiday feasts very seriously here and like to stick to the traditional fare, as well as provide some imaginative dishes along the way. When Christmas Eve arrives at Paws Up, so does a gift-bearing, ho-ho-hoing, but pragmatic Santa Claus himself at each and every guest home, opting for the front door, not the chimney. New Year's Eve features live music, fireworks, and midnight bubbly at Paws Up. The intimate Green O scene is decidedly quieter, while packing the same deliciously enchanting Christmas in Big Sky Country Epiphany, where Mary doesn't quite manage to fully describe it. Paws Up's Christmas package includes 5 nights of accommodation, all daily meals, selected alcoholic beverages, $500 prepaid resort credits per person, and round-trip transportation from and to Missoula International Airport, and a gift-bearing visit from St. Nick on Christmas Eve. For more information, visit pawsup.com.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading True West Magazine, History of the American Frontier, December 2022 edition. The Legendary Jack Dalton by Michael Engelhard, published December 2022. Was he Alaska's greatest backwoodsman and trailblazer? A Haines woman who had known John Jack Dalton as a frequent guest at her childhood home described him as a dapper, well-dressed ladies' man, even at 50. Others dismissed him as a scoundrel. His achievements, however, were undisputed. Skagway's paper, The Daily Alaskan, lauded him as perhaps the most famous pathfinder in the territory. In an 1898 photo, he looks like a good man to have on your side. Small of stature, with broad shoulders, somewhat out of proportion to the rest of his body, Dalton, unrelated to the notorious Dalton brothers, yet a marksman nevertheless, normally went about armed. The Van Dyke beard and thoroughly parted hair added a pinch of respectability to a brawler's round face with high cheekbones and a flat-bridged nose. A fireman aboard a Yukon River sternwheeler deemed him preeminently fit, a square shooter in business, and agreeable, but a bad hombre to cross or run up against. Dalton thought nothing of snowshoeing 50 miles to a cache in one day, admitting to an appetite afterward. Despite his size, he cut an imposing figure in a black wide-brimmed hat, suspenders, calf-high moose-skin moccasins, and sporting a Colt holstered high on his hip, in a working stiff's, not a gunslinger's, way of packing heat. He cleaned up nicely, donning a suit and loosely knotted necktie. His zest for roughing it kept him spry long after his Alaska days. The early 1920s found him prospecting for diamonds in British Guiana. He lived moderately wealthy to be 89, and his longtime physician's impression in 1929 would have made a great epitaph. When Dalton was nearing 75, he looked 55. If provoked, flared up like the 25-year-old firebrand he had once been. The Great Northwoods to the Alaskan Frontier. Details of Dalton's early career are hazy and sometimes contradicting. Probably born in Michigan in July 1856, Jack got little formal schooling. Self-taught, he was rather well-read and well-spoken. Some scrape during his teenage years might have caused him to light out for Oklahoma. He cowboyed for the Hadley Ranch in Baker, Oregon, before moving to Burns, where he ran a small logging outfit. In 1883, he sailed north on a sealer. Already an expert wrangler, hunter, and cook, Dalton became fluent in Chinook, the trade jargon that entwined the Pacific Northwest. His English travel companion, Edward Glaive, an associate of the African explorer Henry M. Stanley, who lived in Livingston in Tanzania, considered Dalton one of the two best men he ever saw handle a paddle. Spending 2 years total with the scout, he likened his route-finding abilities to the talent of a gifted musician who hears a new piece only once and then repeats the whole without difficulty, note for note. In 1886, these skills earned Dalton a place as a roustabout and camp cook on a New York Times-backed expedition to climb 18,000-foot-high Mount St. Elias, astride the Yukon-Alaska border, the second highest peak in the U.S. and Canada. Struggling with fast, silt-laden rivers and through Tyndall Glacier's crevice field, hampered by an ill, corpulent leader, the men had to backtrack. In 1890, Dalton joined a party to chart Southeast Alaska's boondocks, funded by Frank Leslie's Illustrated newspaper. His practical and parlaying finesse cleared passage on one of several ancient paths inland called the Grease Trails. The coast's Chilcats, a Tlilgit Indian band, controlled this particular access. Two other bands ruled the Chilkoot and Wolf White Pass corridors, respectively. The trail network's name referenced oil rendered from tiny Ushuaïan candlefish, a commodity the Chilcats bartered for furs, hides, and copper nuggets from upcountry Athabascan tribes. Decades before, Chilcats raiding the Hudson Bay Company's upper Yukon post, Fort Selkirk, had exiled its factors for the next 80 years. After paying a hefty toll to Chief Kulklux, who had fortified his clan house with two cannons from a Russian shipwreck, the six white men sponsored by Frank Leslie probed the headwaters of their Chilcats Porter's home river. They traversed ravines, icy creeks, crusty snowfields, and the cheerless heading glacier before descending the pass to Kusawa Lake. There, Dalton and the expedition's executive officer, Edward Glaive, parted ways with the others to loop back to the Gulf. Dalton schlepped three pairs of snowshoes, a gold pan, a bread pan, and four saucepans belted around his waist, beside a rifle, revolver, and ammunition. Glaive, an artist and journalist, lugging one big kettle, teapot, blankets, a sack of books, camera, overcoat, and one wild duck, commented on their clanging, which might have aptly served as the heralding strains of the Salvation Army. At one point, perhaps simply because he could, Dalton piggybacked Glaive and his burden to ford a stream. Christopher with a hog leg, patron saint of bush travelers. Glaive, whom fever killed in the Congo, remembered him as a most desirable partner, having excellent judgment, cool and deliberate in time of danger, who possessed great tact in dealing with the Indians. The two secured a canoe and the services of a shaman as guide on the rowdy Alsek that split the coastal range. It spat them out in Dry Bay, soaked through and sore. Hauling horses and hauling ass. Regrouping in the spring of 1891, realizing the potential for a byway of their own, the partners adopted a freighting method unseen in the North. They pastured four short, chunky pack horses bought in Seattle and landed at Lynn Canal's Pyramid Harbor near present-day Haines, Alaska. Waiting to keep his trek to the interior low profile, they hired just two Chilkat guides and an interpreter. No horses had ever been seen in that country. The Indians and miners doubted their worth in such rough, steep terrain. Before Dalton introduced pack stock, native trade parties, snowshoeing in winter, could take more than a month, with up to 100 men each carrying 100 pounds or more. Dalton, expecting deep, soft snows at the 4,750-foot summit, cobbled together four sets of horse snowshoes from spruce sapling loops, webbed with plaited rope that resembled oversized lawn tennis rackets. The horses at first did not value these trappings. Snorting and trembling, they reared up, savagely flailing, and flopping like stranded salmon trying to shake the things off. Somewhere on their journey, a snow bridge collapsed and a horse plunged into the stream coursing underneath. In the lowlands, their mounts floundered up to the saddle blankets in morass. But the riders, unloading, unsaddling, and pulling on lead ropes, saved them. The mosquitoes were so thick that the men sometimes couldn't discern the horses' outlines. At camp, Dalton hobbled the string, lest bugs stampede it for 100 miles. Those nags, soldiering on under 250-pound packs in sub-zero temperatures, impressed Indians used to crawling on hands and knees up treacherous pitches with their wares while strapped into trump lines. They soon paid Dalton for hauling goods into the Yukon River watershed. Challenge came airborne also. Exploring Kluane Lake in an Indian cottonwood dugout with oars and a jury-rigged sail, Dalton and Glaive almost drowned, hypothermic and dashed against cliffs, when a freak storm capsized their boat. They lost irreplaceable gear, Dalton's pocket watch, compass and sextant, rifle, ammo, and cooking utensils. Dalton spent most of 1892 and 1893 scouting a better pack horse trail from Pyramid Harbor. Felling timber, corduroying marshy spots with logs cut short, and building bridges, he smoothed out the trail that would bear his name. Roads to the claims were often poorly maintained, arduous and risky. Streams had to be crossed and recrossed dozens of times. Ice banks girdling them meant wagons teetered several feet to a trough's bottom where currents endangered men and beasts. Snow melt on hot days swelled rivers. Quicksand posed further obstacles. Dan McGinnis, a store clerk in Haines, accused Dalton of trying to monopolize trade in the region, which on March 6, 1893, led to a showdown. McGinnis had told Chilkats about Dalton's planned trail and post on the southwestern Yukon that would siphon off their profits. During a struggle for Dalton's revolver at Murray's cannery store, a shot wounded the clerk, who died on his way to the Juneau Hospital. According to sworn court testimony from the sole eyewitness, Dalton had confronted the seated McGinnis and called him a liar before pistol-whipping him. The fourth blow triggered a shot that tore into McGinnis's soldier. With the final blow, Dalton's weapon again discharged, putting a fatal slug in the clerk's gut. Dalton, initially jailed in Juneau, was acquitted to the dissatisfaction of citizens who asked him to leave Alaska or face consequences. A lynch mob was swayed into granting him 3 days to skedaddle back onto his Yukon turf. 3 houses and a graveyard. That terrain, familiar by now, ranged from mosquito-riddled swamps to a good hard road covered with reindeer moss. The trail he'd blazed by chopping bark from trees as bright beacons culminated after 1,700 feet of switchbacks gaining a pass, the only steep part. At Glacier Camp, 30 miles past the summit, a panorama of 26 ice floes greeted the weary. His trails were well-suited for horses, cattle, and sheep, easier yet longer than the alternate routes over the Chilkoot and White Pass trails. But Dalton's dream realized never drew comparable numbers. Living with a common-law native wife, the Bad Hombre in 1895 established Dalton's post near Nesca Tahin, 3 houses and a graveyard, at an Alsek River crossing. He exchanged blankets, guns, powder, flour, knives, axes, matches, kettles, and tobacco for mink, marten, bear, otter, beaver, and fox pelts his wife's people trapped. Horses proved to be sturdy enough to winter the elevation. The natives, marveling at the snorting, antlerless creatures, feared them. A surveyor Dalton hired fixed the approximate border, and the grandiloquently named Dalton Trail International Boundary Line beyond the summit. A Northwest Mounted Police detachment at Nesca Tahin curbed smuggling and protected Klondikers. 198er reported Dalton's post shelves piled high with calicos and ginghams, shoes, hats, tin pans, plates, and cups, while from the roof beams depended kettles, pail, steel traps, guns, and snowshoes. In 1898, with the owner gone guiding, members of Soapy Smith's Skagway gang supposedly robbed several $1,000s there, but their operating in Canada is unverified. In 1894, Dalton had leased a parcel of land and a warehouse at Haines Mission to trade with local Tilgits. Working with the Studebaker Brothers Manufacturing Company, he also improved commercial freight bobsleds billed to withstand rough, hard usage over the almost impassable Alaska trails. His summit trail fully functioned when Klondike fever broke out in 1897. About 2,000 beeves for feeding the miners tramped it in the following summer. Even reindeer were herded up that subarctic Silk Road. A presumed food shortage in the previous winter had prompted the U.S. government to finance a relief effort. 500 Norwegian reindeer left Haines, though most starved to death before reaching the alpine zone's Lichens. A mere 114 trotted into Circle City nearly a year later, in January 1899. Pioneer grit. From that year on, with the Secretary of the Interior's approval, Dalton charged stampeders dearly for the right to use his highway riches on the American side. $2.50 per head of cattle, horse, mule, or burro, the daily wage of a brewer or baker, collected at a toll tent 3 hours from Lynn Canal. Goats, sheep, and swine brought 50 cents each, and walkers $1. Merchandise was 1 cent a pound. The government decreed that the Chilkets got to commute for free. At Rink Rapid or Fork Selkirk, endpoints of a fork in Dalton's trail, livestock bordered scows or timber rafts, which whisked it downstream to Dawson. Pack trains numbered up to 250 horses, and oxen pulled winter sled loads. McClure's magazine advertised tenderfoot chichancos not set out before May 15th because of the lack of forage in the high country before then, and to take a saddle horse and a few pack horses. A Dalton sideline, the Pony Express Company, conveyed passengers, and once mail, from steamers anchored in Pyramid Harbor to those plying the Yukon River below Rink Rapid, which made for a 10 to 12 day trip between Southeast Alaska's Panhandle and Dawson. Keeping horses at both ends and personally guiding some parties, Dalton charged $150 for the Haynes to Rink Rapid leg or the reverse. Spring transformed many Klondike approaches into hoof-churned sludge. When the road's in a mire, the freighters earn their hire, a drover's song went. They slathered pitch or bacon fat around the ears and eyes of pack animals plagued by a hideous assortment of teasing insects. When freighters' bitten heads got too lumpy to fit into hats, men smeared these ointments on themselves. Dalton jealously guarded his brainchild against trespassers. He shadowed one group, wanting to skip the toll while it wandered through bogs and underbrush and lost most of its stock. His trace stayed competitive until the White Pass and Yukon Route Railway was finished in 1900, but still attracted some business in the decade after. Highways of History. Further inviting progress, in 1905, Dalton reconnoitered a railroad right-of-way from the Central Gulf of Alaska port Cordova up the Copper River. He pummeled a foreman who had supplied Dalton's employees with liquor there and a government agent who refused to sign the payroll for men Dalton supervised. The pugnacious Pathfinder managed a hotel in Haynes before leaving Alaska forever in 1919. He kept a shotgun loaded with rock salt under the bar of his saloon for unruly patrons. Perhaps, owing to his reputation, many challenged him. The Chilkat chief, Cootwait, Indian Jim, afraid of losing his edge on trade, tried to sabotage Dalton's trail venture. Taking a pot shot, he nicked one of his target's fingers. Another tough threatened to open a bar next door to one of Dalton's establishments, but the proprietor told him off with his fists. A trailblazing gene marked one of Dalton's progeny, too. Today's 414-mile gravel umbilicus linking Fairbanks to Prudhoe Bay's Arctic oil fields was named after his second son, James W. Dalton. A University of Alaska graduate serving with the Naval Construction Battalions, CBs, in the Pacific Theater, James helped engineer the distant early warning line during the Cold War and worked as a consultant for the North Slope's Naval Petroleum Reserve. While James fought Japan, the Haynes cutoff stretch of his father's trail revived as the Haynes Highway, connected Tidewater with Haynes Junction in the Yukon on the strategic Alaska-Canada or Alcan Highway. The rest of the 350-mile original track to Fort Selkirk lies overgrown or has been erased by logging roads or rivers channel switching. Still, the Klondike's only trail, built largely by one man and as a toll road, remains a token scar, a sign of pioneer grit on North America's final frontier. True West Magazine, December 2022 edition. Camping with Charlie at the Russell by Steve Friesen. The annual auction in Great Falls, Montana exceeded expectations as always. The Russell, this year's premier fundraising event at the C.M. Russell Museum in Great Falls, Montana, featured lectures, banquets, a show where art could be purchased, and three auctions. Held August 18th through the 21st and focused on the work of contemporary Western artists, the event offered collectors an opportunity to acquire new art and meet its creators. In addition to the contemporary work, the final gala offered some excellent works by Charles Russell. Horses and riders were a popular theme within the contemporary artwork sold at the Russell. The highest amount gathered by a current work of art was Jeremy Winborg's Pitmaken, Braver Than the Braves, depicting the female warrior Pitmaken leading a group of braves on horseback. The painting sold for $84,000, well over twice the projected high bid. Jason Rich's Wild Horse Ridge also exceeded expectations, bringing in $64,400. It showed a group of wild horses running along a ridge with snow-capped peaks in the background. Homeward Bound, Joe Cronenberg's painting of a cowboy on horseback crossing a river, continued that trend by greatly exceeding its projected high bid with a take of $42,000. Brenna Kimbrough's Beauty, an unusual sculpture of a horse head, and Brooke Wetzel's Where the Cowgirls Ride Away more than tripled their projected high bids. It was a good night for horse lovers. As might be expected, the works by Charles Russell brought the highest bids at the event. The top earner of the weekend auctions was High, Wide, and Handsome Montana Show Rider, which sold for $468,000. Antelope Hunting hammered down at $198,900, while I Climbed Fast and Stuck My Head Out of the Top Without Looking, and Then Froze Solid Enough, brought $111,150. Even a 1914 calendar, which featured a reproduction of Russell's painting Sagebrush Sport, went for $6,435, greatly exceeding its high estimate of $1,000. Charlie Russell once wrote, "What's the matter with packing your war bag and heading to my camp? A robe is spread and the pipe lit for you always." The C.M. Russell Museum houses that camp, his home and studio, and one of the largest collections of his artwork and the world, making it well worth a special trip to Great Falls. The auctions at the Russell this year garnered over $2,484,649 in income, helping fund the museum and ensuring that Charlie's pipe continues to burn.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.